please call to order. The very first thing we'd like to do is to just quickly look backwards, and we miss the people that have been so foundational here that are no longer trustees, but we are very excited about the go forward. Matthew Schomer is brand new trustee, Tom Toll, and Michael Tagliandi. Now, I'm from Pittsburgh, so I had Tagliandis and all sorts around. We just called everyone Tags. Is that what a lot of people say?
Yeah, okay. The other Michaels here, it'll be easier.
Got it. Okay. But we're thrilled to have all of you guys on board and just look forward to your contributions, both individually and collectively. So very, very excited about that. So we're going to go ahead and start off with a moment of silence for the people that are no longer with us. Thank you. So the first thing we have are the minutes of the August 10th meeting. Was it here where we had all of the people who were getting our rebates?
Refunds?
The refunds. Those in the minutes?
It's in the consent agenda.
It's in the consent agenda. Okay, so we'll get there. Okay. Anything on the minutes anyone wants to flag or comment on? If not, then can we have, I don't think I said, the regular and supplemental meetings are called to order, and then we're recessing the supplemental meeting. Usually, Josh gives me a little nudge when I mess that up.
We missed it.
He must be.
We did that good. This time
Josh must be distracted. We'll figure out what it is later that's distracting him, that he didn't claim a footfall. It seems like one of those. Okay. So can we have a motion to approve minutes?
Make a motion for the minutes.
Okay. Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The detailed consent agenda. Can you just comment on the extent of the refunds? I know there's a good reason.
Right.
Yeah.
I had planned to do that. So you'll notice in your detailed consent agenda, we have a lot of refunds this month. And that's because Brenda has been working with a team of employees to go through our old outstanding refunds for people that aren't vested. We have 474, I think, when we started the project, which is way more than a year's worth of refunds or whatever. So we've been actively trying to contact people to say, take your money, because it's rightfully their money. So I think they did 71 or something recently. They've been making very good progress on finding these people. Oftentimes they don't know they're owed the money. So that's what these refunds are. They don't get interest on it. They don't get the city side, but it's their contributions that they made. So that's why there's so many. And you'll see that as they continue to work through the refund process. Any questions on the refunds?
Okay.
There's one other item on here that I wanted to point out. Item 4A is an item you haven't seen before. And what happens when you approve a retirement for somebody, you're also approving their drop annuitization if they have a drop, and when they pass away, that doesn't need to come back to the board for the recipient of who's receiving that drop. But we do have one situation where a person passed away, the board hadn't previously approved their retirement, so 4A is an unusual one. That's what that item's about.
John, does someone think trying to speak up?
No.
Okay. All right, thank you. We have a motion to approve the consent agenda.
I'll move.
Okay. Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Public comment. I don't see anyone physically here. Is there anyone on the phone who would like to speak up?
To press 5-star and then move to the
Okay, great. All right, so we're going to move to item D1, board officer election. Kelly, why don't you frame it?
Okay. So our statute requires that every June we elect the chair, the vice chair, and the deputy vice chair. which June doesn't make any sense with our timing of our elections, but we do it in June. And then when we get new trustees in, we can do it again. You can actually elect officers every month if you wanted to. But since we've had both the deputy vice chair and the vice chair roll off, we currently have those two positions open. So we wanted to give you the opportunity to elect amongst yourselves people to fill those positions.
So we really need all of you to sort of speak up. If someone who, I would say that the main one that I guess if something happened to me, they would step in,
right?
But more than anything, if there's kind of one-off things that need to be discussed sometimes, but not, we don't need a forum, but Kelly just wants to get, you know, kind of a sound check, then a lot of times that person is brought in. As a practical point, you know, when it was Bill, I mean, he, it was more me, so, I mean, I love him, evolved, and everything, and I love supporting him where I was, you know, the vice chair initially, so.
Does it make sense to have, like, those positions represented by one side or the other?
I think that makes sense. You know, other things could make sense too. But yeah, I mean, sure. I think it's.
I'm sorry. What was that comment that Tina made that it should represent? I'm sorry, I didn't hear what exactly was said.
Versus, you know, police and fire.
So
elected versus appointed.
Since the new statute came into play in 2017, the officers have always been. The chair has always been. And then one of the, either the vice chair or the deputy vice chair was one of the police or fire reps or a non-member, and then the mayoral appointees, how it's been. It's really at the discretion of the group. But we've always,
so,
as you're saying, representative from
right.
So are you asking, I guess I don't know how this process goes, like people who want to serve, volunteer, and you want that to happen at this meeting, or is there a? I mean, what is that process? What is that process? If you can describe, please.
I think we're just looking for who's interested in either role and then gaining consensus on that. If we can, I guess we can move it over.
We can bring it back.
Yeah, we can bring it back, and people can just independently email me. If they're interested, and then we can.
That might be better, but like, what are the roles again? It's like you're the chair, no? Oh, wait, I can't see.
Vice chair.
Vice chair and deputy vice chair. So before it was Bill and Armando.
Right.
It's just like in the beauty pageant. If I'm not able to serve for any reason, you know, then
it's like a vice president
fill in for me.
Yeah.
President.
Nick, Nick, this is Nancy Rocha. I don't need to email you, but I will volunteer to serve on that in the vice chair capacity. And I am not appointed by the mayor. I'm a non-member, so.
Okay. Great. Well, let's do that. So if anyone else is interested in either of the two positions, if you would email me, and then we'll bring it to
next month.
Closure next month. Thank you, Nancy.
Yeah. You should do it. Yeah. Did you know that?
Okay. Anything else? In terms of collecting BMIs.
Well, they could elect new chair if they choose to do so, or
I mean,
we can the board. But
yeah.
I was thinking we would wait and see what happens with the mayor in your position
before
we did the chair.
Yeah,
because that's uncertain at this
point.
So
we're still looking for clarification on the rules relative to my tenure and so on. So
it should be all three.
Huh?
Nominate all three of them.
Yeah. So hopefully we'll get closure from that soon.
Well, wouldn't it make sense for us to know what exactly your tenure is going to be before we move on the other positions? Because it would
I'll either be reappointed or off the board, right? Isn't it kind of binary, Josh?
Yeah, I think that's right. We're hoping to get clarification here in the near future. So hopefully by the next board meeting we'll have clarity on it.
If for any reason I'm off, we'll let people know
right.
before the meeting so they'll have clarity on it.
And so do we then, again, well, how does that process work? We just vote on whomever wants to serve?
If we're, yes. If this was a normal process, let's say Nick didn't want to run again and the mayor appointed a new person, so all three positions were open, then we would the board would elect all three, chair, vice chair, deputy vice chair. But because we don't know the status of Nick at this point, we decided just to list this as the two officers. We could do all three next month.
Yeah, I mean, if there's by no means, if I am reappointed, that's all solidified, you know, then it's the will of the board whether I would continue in that role, just like
mutiny.
Huh?
Mutiny.
Yeah. it's called Republican democracy, I think. Representative democracy. So Nancy, if all myself, my position, as well as the other two, would be open for. Adjustment or continuation. Well, we definitely need two for the vice chair and the deputy vice chair, and then if the will of the board is that there should be another chair, then so be it. So I think it makes sense to get clarity on me before we do that. Does that make sense?
Yes, great.
Okay. All right, so board committee appointments. Okay, we purposely did it in small print so you can't see what you've been appointed to. Okay, so we have, first we have the audit committee, which we propose would be myself, Tony, and Matt. The Professional Services Committee, chaired by Steve, with Mark Marcus and Michael. Then have Tom, move from his role as an external to a board member and chair of the IAC. Other members of that would be Michael, Nancy, and Tina. And then we have, in terms of the external, I think everyone was on it before, other than we moved Ken. Ken really wanted to serve, and we were supportive of that. Move him to an external. And remind us that, Brian, what you need in terms of a quorum for that?
It needs to be a majority of the outside members on the committee and at a meeting. So if all four board members show up, we need at least five outside to have a quorum.
Okay. In order to just meet or to make a recommendation or is it kind of the same thing?
Josh, you want
to? Yeah, I mean, basically to be an official meeting,
yes.
You need
okay.
a quorum. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So I guess with one proviso, my status will be worked out. Is everyone on board with this? And can we have a motion to appoint trustees as designated to serve on the committees nominated by me. Okay, second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. All right. Brenda, student council elections are over. Go ahead, you take over.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning, everyone. Wanted to give an update on the audit of the DPST financial audit. We are still waiting to receive the HUF audited financial statements. Again, they are material to the pension system, and we cannot proceed or go forward with completing our financials without them. However, We have recently received K-1s for both of the HUF funds, so we believe that that is a good indicator that hopefully in the next week or two, we will see the actual audited financial statements, and then we'll be able to move forward with completing the financials, getting the information to the actuary, and then once we receive the information from the actuary, rolling it through our financials and through the ACFA or the comprehensive report that we do. So we think we're entering kind of the final stage, the 45 to 60 days, once we get the audited financials from HUF, and then we'll be able to complete DPFC financials. Staff is working on doing what they can ahead of time, so that we'll be positioned as well as we can when we actually do receive the financials.
So I know on K-1s they have that box, I should know what number it is, that shows what the value is. It either can be a fair market value or tax value, depending on how they do it. Is there anything there that indicates anything?
No. We tried that last year. We tried that last year, trying to make some inference from there, and it didn't work. So.
Ryan, just because I think it's important for people to all understand, the HUF number was how big on the 21 financials, and up from what? Just
the 21 financials, it was 157. Yeah, it went from 110 to 193, and then we took it down. The Q2 value was 163.
Okay.
So it swings wildly.
Yeah, I mean, so this is a huge percentage of our private, and a very meaningful percentage of our overall. The way that this system works is that if you're an LP, you have to wait on the GP to produce the numbers. That's their role. We haircutted it some, but, you know, in order to sort of pass audit scrutiny, you know, that's your source document is what the general partner produces, you know, on your behalf. My understanding is that these are largely proven but undeveloped, or
proven undeveloped.
Yeah. So if you think about like the end of the WIP, this is the far end that can fluctuate, you know, the most relative to you know, the price of the commodity. So it's just one of those things where we inherited this situation. You know, these were funds that we got into these funds
2008.
Yeah. So, you know, a long time ago. So the last decision we made was 2008 on this, and, you know, we're living with the consequence. We hope for a happy ending, but, you know, you don't know. And just their delay in producing source documents that we can then rely on is why, you know, one of the main reasons why it has taken and is taking so long to produce, you know, our final report. A lot of that is hard for people to kind of see where it sources back to, but that's the reality of it. Anything else, Brenda? Okay, Kelly.
Okay, so
monthly contribution.
Right.
Report, yes.
So we talked a little bit about this in the orientation for the new trustees, but this is a report that you'll see every month that we started back in 2017 or 20, I think pretty much right away with the new board, to track the fluctuation in the city contributions over time, because we know that's a critical driver of our funding level. It's not as interesting now as it used to be, because since the floor has declined this year, the floor is no longer a factor. So we're not really seeing a lot of dynamic changes in these numbers. There's consistency on the city side. They're still struggling with hiring the numbers that they projected, although because of the big raises that they've given, the payroll is actually more than expected. So right now, as of the end of the last pay period in July, these numbers are a little bit delayed, they had 107 less employees than they had projected, 250 police officers under their projection, but fire was over by 143. As far as numbers go, on the next
question.
Page. Yes.
I'm sorry. I think recently on a council meeting they were talking about cutting some of these positions for budgetary, I mean, finding more reserves. What happens in this situation? So I heard like 70 in the police. What happens? Because they don't hire them we can never get to that point anyway. So how does that affect this?
I didn't see that, as far as I know, they've been adding, and I know they've struggled to fill the positions that they've added over time. They've had a strong commitment to hiring and to pay increases, but it's hard nationwide to hire, especially on the police side. So I'm not sure. Last I heard, they were budgeting for more police and fire and trying to fill those positions.
I think they budget, I want to say, 300 police. The problem is they just can't fill them. My understanding is, and I'm not an expert at all, if they eliminate 70 positions, then they would have 70 times whatever, $70,000 basically. They wouldn't have to have in the budget for the police. They could put somewhere else.
That's my understanding.
Yeah. But, yeah, we haven't hit our targets in forever.
Fires. Fires always the next
one. Yeah. Nobody wants to be fired.
Okay.
So
the calendars.
We do have a guest. I don't know if Council Member Mendelson has more information. And I hate to put you on the spot. I apologize.
Good to be here. Let me cover.
Wherever you're comfortable.
So hi, I'm Tara Mendelson. I am a Dallas City Council Member. I actually chair the Public Safety Committee. Previously, I chaired the Budget Committee. So we call it Government Performance and Financial Management. And I'm the chair of our legislative committee. So I'm here today, honestly, because this is the number one legislative priority for me, and we need to be good partners in solving what I think is a financial crisis. So we'll just say it like that. For the forecast on hiring, for this fiscal year, we have not met the goal. The goal was 250 hires. At this point, we have 185. There's another class expected, but it isn't confirmed yet, so I don't know where we'll end up for this fiscal year, which ends at the end of this month. For the upcoming budget, it's not been approved. There has been a budget amendment. The proposed budget by the city manager included 290 positions for police. That's completely unrealistic. Since COVID began, we've never hired even 200. So there has been a budget amendment introduced to reduce that number to 250. And that passed. So now it's part of the budget. Next Wednesday, there'll be an additional amendment coming. I know I have several. And we'll then approve the budget, of course, before the end of the month. So where the hiring goal ends up is almost not as important as the actual ability for the recruiting element of the DPD. And the commitment, I think, on council side is if they can hire more than we've even budgeted, let's go into reserve to get them on. So I don't think there's any question that we know we need more officers. There is a problem with hiring. And I think they've worked really, really hard this year to get to the 185. So I really question how they could even get to 250. Last night I talked to Chief Garcia, and apparently I'm going on a recruiting trip. So thank you for your support, and thank you for working on this so diligently, and I will
already
take a text about your
plan. Oh, thank you. Well, solutions start with engagement. So the fact that you're here, I always think that showing up is such a big part of any problem solving. So thank you. You know, the way that we look at it, the word crisis gets thrown around a lot. This was definitely in crisis way back when in 2017, and thanks to the steady hand of the two people I'm looking at right here and a few others, there was a new life was sort of breathed into the thing. So the way we look at it is that we've created, there was a ship that was leaking fuel that we have stopped the leaking. We've stabilized it. But we need more fuel to take everyone to their final destination as we look for decades more, not in the short term, not the medium term, but in the long term. So in terms of how we think about things, We think there is stability. One of the things that I am most proud of is that when we started, you could clearly see who the mayoral appointees were and who were the non. I mean, you could just tell by the way what people said and they voted. I think someone could come here now, and if they didn't know who they were, they wouldn't know whose is whose, which really speaks to the quality of the people here, the unity, and everyone focused on getting the job done and doing the right thing. So.
Well, I do think you need a long-term fix, and
we agree.
What has to be different than 2017 is that we have to work together, and there was a very terrible, contentious environment, but it also meant we lost a lot of officers. We are not in the same position. That cannot happen. And so I've already been talking to retirees. I've already been talking to active. I'm talking to fire station next week. But we have to work together because I think we lost almost 600 officers during that whole period. So we're already stretched.
I would also like to take the opportunity to also talk about perception, because when you were before the council several years ago, it was sort of like the idea that it's been fixed. And what we were trying to say what was fixed or what became better was policy and governance and the structure behind how we do things and how we invest and just better, you know, stewardship. However, the financial issue or funding has always been problematic, and as far as conveying that to the community, we have to say it's not the structure around it, but the financing has never been where it should be or where it needs to be to get to a healthier state. So I think we often talk about like having a PR and basically starting to explain things. Yes, it's better in structure and in policy, but the funding has always been not there properly or not sufficient.
So I'm just telling you that the way we are talking about it and I'm talking about it is to say that there was a Band-Aid put on so that we could fix it in 25. And that really has to be the message. I think people who know understand that's what's happening, but I do think that there's a public perception that it did get fixed in 2017 and, oh, no, it's back again. But, I mean, the legislation is clear. It was never fixed long term. So that consistent message that you share will be important.
Yeah, and I would just add one more thing, which is that it's unfair to say to the, you know, our stakeholders, give us more money unless we can show that we can be good stewards of that money. And so I think the biggest difference between, you know, way back when is that there was poor stewardship of resources. We're going to go over a historical record of private investments where you can see many things are never returned, you know, the dollar invested, and that's a form of just sort of time theft. It's more than anything, and I think that where we feel now, and we know the burden's on us to communicate that to the stakeholders, is that we now believe we can be good stewards of additional capital, and I think that's an incredibly important part of any of you know getting this done the right way.
Well said.
If we have a hard time finding, you know, full-time actives, like, have you explored any volunteer programs or anything of that sort to help the issue?
We have them in place. I mean, we have reserves.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, that helps from a public safety standpoint and overall community, and they have expertise in a lot of different areas that, quite frankly, a lot of us don't. You know, as far as for the pension and everything, you know, the reserve, they don't get paid. They don't put anything into the pension, so it helps a little bit, and they're not significant in numbers where it's not like Harris County where they have, I think, thousands of them. So they're helpful, and we're appreciative, especially for their expertise in different areas. But as far as for this issue, they don't. There's a national issue with hiring police and firefighters, and we're lucky. When I went to a conference in Baltimore, and the guy who was leading the discussion said, you know, they said, we'll hire you right now. I mean, he asked the question, everybody there is having issues. We're lucky that the fire are so respected here and people still want to volunteer and want to do the job. It's nationally, there's an issue with hiring police.
So that was by far the most interesting contribution report we've had in a while, but probably not stray from that item anymore.
Usually it's Josh that rebukes process on that failure review.
That was done up the chain of command.
Josh, you're slow this morning.
He was giving me the evil eye.
Do you have your yogurt or not?
I was just going up the chain of command.
All right,
failure
yeah.
Failure review, so
okay.
It's just, you know.
Okay. All right. We have, okay, Kelly, trustee of travel and education.
Okay, this is the standing item every month that you'll see where you can request to attend one of the conferences that we have listed here, and then the board will approve that, or if you have something else in mind, we can add it for board approval. These are a little ways out, January and May, but here's three NCPERS conferences. So if anybody's interested in anything, let Carol know, and we'll add your initials and get it on a future agenda.
Personally, I think actuarial education is always the best thing that we most can use. I think we all can spell the word and have a good understanding of it, but you know, anything more we can get in group education on how the actuarial side of things work, I don't think anyone here feels like they understand that as well as they understand investments or you know other items of importance. So, okay, HB 4034 update.
This is the bill that was passed in the last legislative session that increased the line of duty death benefits for survivors where their spouse or their parent died while in the line of duty. So we were able to process these. It was actually a lot more complicated than you would imagine. I mean, the first step was trying to identify who these people are. Some of them went back to 1958, and names had changed, and sometimes there used to be a rule that if they remarried, they were off the pension, and then they could get back on the pension. We believe that we have identified everybody, except for I think there could be one more police spouse out there that we can't identify. That's the only person that I think could still be out there. So we've done that. We've done the analysis of everybody. Everybody's in a different situation, so it was quite an undertaking. But we have that done. They will receive their increased payments starting with this paycheck, which is what the bill requires. So we have that done. In doing that, we did discover basically four errors, and these are going to result in underpayments and interest owed, not anything like we've seen before to the large ones. All of these related to the benefit supplement, where when the person turned 55, they should have gotten a 3% increase in their pay or a $75 minimum. Or the children should have gotten it. So there was four kind of different situations. One, two, three of these, I believe, with interest will be over $10,000, but not a whole lot over $10,000. So I needed to alert you that we have an underpayment of more than $10,000. So I wanted to let you know those. Any questions on this item? Okay.
Ryan?
Yep. Clicker. All right, firstly, and most importantly, I want to reintroduce Christina Wu as our Deputy CIO. Welcome her back to DPSC. Christina, you want to give a quick intro?
Sure. Christina Wu, I'm happy to be back. I was here originally, and I went for some other opportunities. So I was most recently at Fort Worth Employees Retirement Fund, covering all private markets over there. And before that, I was with Toyota North America in their treasury and investments group. I'm glad to be back.
Good to have you back. Well, yeah, we're thrilled to have you.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, I'll get a portfolio update. I'm going to jump around a little bit, but first on the private market asset liquidation, we're at $52 million in distributions year-to-date, majority coming from AEW and the J.P. Morgan Maritime Fund. They've slowed down quite a bit the last couple of months, so we've had about $2.6 million over July and August come back. On the global growth equity search, which is the replacement for Invesco that we terminated in March, we've gone through the RFP process, and we've narrowed it down to two firms that we plan to have come present to the IAC in 2 weeks. T. Rowe Price and WCM. Me and Akshay are going up to see T. Rowe in person on Monday. So we'll have them come in. on rebalancing, if you guys remember, we updated the active global equity targets from 8 to 6%, and then small cap down from 4 to 3%. So in late August, we moved $92 million from active global equity into the passive account with Northern Trust, which is the ACWI IMI index fund. We use Russell as our transition manager there. And so what they do, they come in and they'll take a pro rata sleeve of $92 million in securities from each of the accounts that we're rebalancing. They do all the trading on our behalf, and then we invest it into the index fund at the same trade date. So it makes it a little bit more efficient. Trading costs on that were about 8 bips. Year to date on the overall portfolio, we're at 6.9%, and then 10.7% for the public assets, which make up 70%. So jumping back up to the safety reserve, we're at the 18-month mark. In March 22, we put the safety reserve into a drawdown mode. Over that time, we've had 190-ish of private market proceeds come back. We've reinvested $84 million of that into global equity. We've held 105 back in the safety reserve, which is extended. If we hadn't done any of that or we didn't have any private market proceeds, we'd be running through the end of the safety reserve. We have plenty of other liquid assets, but the cash and short-term bonds would be depleted by now. So we've restocked it as we've gone. We're to the point in the markets and, you know, into this drawdown mode that we think it's prudent to look at how we operationally exit the drawdown and refill it back up to target. So we have a discussion with the IAC in 2 weeks at the September 28th meeting to talk through what that looks like, where it's coming from, and we'll need some policy revisions to get that done. But just jumping to slide 42 on the safe reserve, we're at 113 right now, $30 million in cash, 66 in short-term core bonds compared to the target of 177. With our projected outflow of $9.5 million per month, that covers us through June of 24. If you look at the cash balance, we got $30 million at the end of August. That's getting depleted naturally through the benefit outflows into October. So that's why we need to kind of figure out where the money's coming from to start filling this back up. Moving ahead to the asset allocation detail, because we're overweight to private markets, all the liquid public market asset classes are basically at target or under target. So we'll need to pull money out of some of these asset classes away from target to refill the safe reserve. So that's what we're going to come back with on what the policy language looks like, how we go about doing that, over what time frame. Any questions there on plans for the safety reserve?
I think it's always good to know for new people and existing people that we have this fundamental shortfall in terms of what we pay out every month versus what we bring in, and that's this $9.5 million number. That the safety reserve, think of that as like a temporary gas tank. It doesn't produce fuel, it just sort of holds fuel. So that's been the conduit by which we've taken these private market proceeds, put it in this short-term conduit, and it's been a holding tank then to help fund this gap. We don't really control, although, you know, I really think of everything I've seen in the last, you know, since I've been involved over the last 6 or 7 years, the team has done is monetizing private assets, which were so problematic. They've done just an amazing job of that. So it's a big problem. It hasn't felt day-to-day like a big problem because we've had this liquidity from private markets funding it. But it was just as big of a problem then as it is now. The best answer would be we'd have enough officers, you know, that are paying that there wouldn't be a shortfall. And then what we have in investments would be compounding at a rate that would satisfy the long-term obligations. That's what we're trying to get to.
Has there ever been a time when there was no gap between that? And the,
okay. I don't think so. It hasn't. It's kind of the natural cycle in a pension plan, though. At some point, you just have so many retirees. Ours is exaggerated because the retirees' benefits are just so large at this point.
So it's realistic to get back to that at some point.
Yes.
Okay.
The other challenge, too, I think, is that In our investment policy, while we have target allocations to certain asset classes, we have not, there's no specific language on once we get an influx of money where how it's being spread apart. I mean, that's kind of, but it's kind of intentional. But equally, we're seeing the reverse. This is the first discussion we've had where, okay, now we need to add to the reserve, and the, where we would normally take from the illiquid privates, our legacy assets, now that we're coming to a problem where we can't squeeze, we're getting to the most problematic, where we can't, it's not as easily determined when we're going to get those assets. So now we're looking back to how we spread the money across our public side. Am I right in that respect, that how we're going to, where we're going to take it?
Yeah, it, I mean, we'll get money back, but it's more unknown when it's going to occur.
Yes, exactly.
We're talking about how when we get a notice saying we have more money, we'll, you know, have money coming in, but we don't know when that's going to be.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's more of a problem now. It's just more obvious of a problem.
Right.
The problem was solved through good efforts of the team in monetizing private assets. A lot of those were problematic private assets and creating tomorrows for some of the others that we're aware of where there actually is a chance for some liquidity on some of the ones that have been problematic before. So it's the same problem. It's just that we've done a good job of executing on a solution to the problem, but staff is putting us on notice, appropriately so, that
those, we're under a year.
Yeah, that we may not, be able to count on the same thing we've been counting on for the last couple of years, but the problem is the problem.
Yeah, and I would, the safe reserve refilling is not, we have 1.28 billion of liquid, very liquid assets. It's just reallocating those back into the safe reserve. And then, you know.
Well, and but also knowing that when you put it in the safety reserve, you're not hitting your benchmark return. You know, we have 6.5.
Right.
Just think of that as a clock that's always turning. And for every dollar that doesn't produce 6.5, you need another dollar that produces proportionally more than 6.5. Yes, Leo?
Nick, and everyone. So interest rates have fortunately been coming up. So I looked up yesterday, a 6-month treasury is yielding 5.53. These invest more or less in that and other high quality credits. And so the, between the cash and the safety reserve, we're making a lot more. So I understand a couple of years ago it was essentially a zero. So the cost of that insurance was a lot higher.
Yeah.
Right now we're, you know, 1% to 1.5% behind the assumed rate of return. So the opportunity cost has gotten a lot more reduced.
Right.
And that is a lot more advantageous. So it's not a bad time to top it off, if you will, that temporary gap tax.
I agree. But if the gap's 1%, 1.5%, that means he's something else that's doing 1%, 1.5% more.
Sure.
That's
70%.
You're right before. It was 4 or 5 under.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're exactly right. But it still is not ideal. Yeah.
Okay. Going back a few slides here. So on the drawdown, I mean, we're 18 months into the state reserve being in drawdown. If you look, this is looking at major equity markets, we're still in a drawdown, less so than we were last summer. When we talk about the size of the safe reserve, it was designed to be 18 months because that's the typical length of a drawdown. We're going to be a little bit longer here, but we're at the point in the markets where we've reinvested at lower levels in equity. We can potentially take some of that back and top it off. Public market performance, making up 70%. Of the portfolio, we're on 38 here. Overall public up 10.7%, equity up 12.5% year to date. If we look down to Eastern Shore, they're the U.S. small cap manager. They've underperformed a little bit since we've hired them, but they showed good downside protection last month, being down 2 compared to the benchmark of 5. And you can see just between Boston Partners and Manulife as our value managers and Walter Scott as our growth, there's been quite a difference between returns, value and growth this year. Moving to the fixed income, a lot of green on this page. So we've outperformed the benchmark overall in public fixed income across all time periods. Good returns year to date out of the bank loan portfolio, 9.9%. We ended the month with $1.917 billion in assets, $83 million in net outflows, and $172 in investment gain and other income. So this chart we usually show once a quarter, but I think it's, you know, important enough that we should just add it every time in the portfolio update, but it's looking at the last 5 years, how much of our that 9.5 million gap has been covered by private market inflows. So overall, it's 105%. The 2 years that we have not generated enough yet are 2020 with COVID and just in the last few months with private market distribution slowing down. We're hopeful to have a few things by year end, but see how that goes. But we've been lucky to be able to generate over 100% of that outflow with private market proceeds. Okay, so moving ahead on the calendar, Makita is going to do an overview of the fixed income portfolio today along with their performance report. I got a few slides leading into it on fixed income and where we're at today. This is looking at yields now versus the 10-year range and the 10-year average or median. Basically, we're getting paid to be invested in fixed income again. On the left side of the page is investment grade. Most of those are near the 10-year high and up about 300 basis points, 3% over that average for the last 10 years. On the right side of the page, it's showing credit fixed income, so EM debt, EM corporate, high yield, and leveraged loans. So we're invested in leveraged loans, bank loans on the far right, U.S. high yield, and then EM debt. So our fixed income allocation of 25 is made up 13% investment grade, 12% credit. This is just a little bit of the fixed income math here. This is showing, on the left side of the page, just returns and maturity across treasuries and the different asset classes in fixed income. Let me see if I can zoom in on this. On the right side of this chart here, there we go. That's showing correlation to the stock market, U.S. stock market. So obviously in treasuries, they are uncorrelated or less correlated. As you get more into the credit space, they're more correlated with the equity markets. And then the chart on the right is showing what would happen to valuations of fixed income if there was a 1% rise being the blue bar in rates and a 1% fall in rates being the gray bar. So the longer duration you have with the 30-year treasury, the more a change in rates is going to affect the pricing of that security. Any questions before I hand it over to Leo? Okay, we're going to jump ahead to the fixed income, then we'll come back to performance.
Leo and Colin, what I'd ask you guys as you go through, you know, we want you to bring more vivid color to our situation in terms of, you know, your insights, but also I think you guys bring us access to the market and the world that we don't have ourselves. So everything you can tell us in addition about what other pension, you know, common problems you're seeing that we have, that others have, common opportunities, what you're seeing in the marketplace, what are trends in allocating, all those sorts of those data points that you could sort of incorporate in, I think would be real helpful.
Yeah, I'll just make a few remarks. First of all, I will start congratulating the three new trustees on the appointment and elections. Makita has been serving as the investment consultant since 2018, and this group has recently gone through a process where they re-underwritten and retained us, but also added a specialist consultant to assist with any future private market commitments. That is important because as we're dealing with this discussion about liquidity, in the roadmap, Ryan had potential new investments into liquid assets as early as perhaps 2024, and that means that in addition to the much more limited distributions you're getting on the liquids, you will have at least the current pace of benefit payments that you have, and in addition, you're going to have to begin to fund capital calls. So there's going to be potentially a bigger draw on liquidity starting somewhere 12 to 18 months out than we have today.
Yeah, I mean, it's dependent on when stuff comes back.
Of course.
But, yeah, it's going to go from 9.5 being covered from inflows to 9.5 plus outflows.
Yeah, and those legacy assets which have been the funding source eventually will be off the books. So that's one thing. The other one, Nick, to your point, the percentage deficit in terms of money coming in and money going out is a bit larger for these funds versus peers. So, you know, it is what it is. It's nothing that can be changed right away. It's going to take many years, but that's why you have an actuary and there is a plan to get this, you know, this plan more financially sound over time. But it's like an oil supertanker. It takes a while to move it from one position to another, but I think we're on a good trajectory here. So our goal today is to review for you your fixed income assets. We're going to focus only on your public fixed income portfolio. So Colin will lead that for a few minutes. And then I will provide a performance update on your fund. I think the goal is to look at different asset classes at meetings. So I believe the next meeting will be looking at your public equity portfolio as well. So with that, maybe we'll start, Colin.
Sounds good. Good morning, everybody. For you, those of you that don't know me, I'm Colin Kowalski. I've been to a few meetings, but I figured it was good to reintroduce myself. I'll go ahead and do a quick overview of DPFP's fixed income holdings, and then if there's any, if Leo, if you want to make any comments on trends or what we're doing with other clients, we can do so at the end. Go ahead and we'll turn to the page 110 of the materials, and this just gives public fixed income and cash at an aggregate level. So DPFP has a target allocation of 25% to public fixed income and cash assets. As of now, that's at a 20.7% allocation with $400.5 million. That's spread across five different asset classes. So you have cash and short-term bonds. And as Ryan mentioned earlier, that makes up your safety reserve assets. Investment-grade bonds as well, that's more your core allocation. And then on the credit side, which makes up about half of it, you have bank loans, high-yield bonds, and emerging markets debt. And I'll get into those different asset classes a bit on the next slide. In terms of performance measurement for the composite, we use the Bloomberg Multiverse Index. That's a broad-based measure of the market opportunity globally for fixed income, and so that merges your global traditional fixed income with global high yield. And so we'll use that as a performance measurement for the total fund. In terms of the role that this plays in the portfolio, obviously to provide income and inflation protection. Another large role is diversification. Traditionally, fixed income assets are used to diversify against equity risk, and so that's one of the main roles. Capital preservation and also liquidity, especially amongst your safety reserve assets. But as you'll see, almost all the funds held here are either daily or monthly liquid. I'll go ahead and jump one more page to 111, and this gives a breakdown of the different asset classes within public fixed income and then your managers. On the top of the chart here, and I'll mention that this data is all as of the end of 6/30, so fairly recent. And then at the end of this document, there's an appendix that sort of gives a lot more detail on some of the summary comments made here. So at the very top of the chart, you'll see cash and short-term bonds. Those are your safety reserve assets, as Ryan noted earlier. The target for those two combined is 9%. That's slightly underweight as a result of drawing down the safety reserve over the past year or so. These are low interest rate risk assets, so their duration is on the lower end. The yield to maturity for at least the short-term bonds is 5.6%. So that's come up a lot this past year and a half. I have for that specifically, a year and a half ago, that was yielding 1.2%. So it's come up a lot right now. It's a great time to be invested, especially in short-term bonds. In the middle of the page there, you'll see investment-grade bonds, and that's by Longfellow. So there's a 4% target, and the 4% allocation on target for that one. This is the highest interest rate risk bucket within fixed income with a 6.4-year duration and still a strong yield to maturity at 5.3%, low credit risk, daily liquidity on your core bonds. And then moving into the second half of the chart, you'll see credit assets, that's bank loans managed by Aristotle Pacific Capital. This one has the lowest interest rate risk, so at 0.4 years. These are floating. Most of the assets held here are floating rate bank loans, and so as interest rates go up during the year, the rates float on these securities as well. So that gives you really strong protection against rising interest rates. And you'll see that in the performance for this, for Bankland specifically, for the trailing year, those up double digits. Such a strong performer within public fixed income. Moderate credit risk, monthly liquidity on that one. And then you have your high-yield bonds managed by Loomis Sayles. Medium interest rate risk with 3.7 years on duration, a very high yield of maturity, moderate credit risk. And then at the very bottom, emerging markets debt managed by MetLife. That's actually a new fund that was added in October of last year to replace Brandywine within the emerging markets debt allocation. A little bit higher interest rate risk and high yield as well on this one, with a little bit higher credit risk when you look at an emerging markets debt. You have to take into account country risk. So that's the only mandate that's holding bonds outside of the U.S. here, and so that's a factor as well.
Well, I just want to point out the cash allocation. It's not like that's earning nothing. It's in the money market with J.P. Morgan earning 5.25. So we're getting yield across all the asset classes.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, Ryan.
So before we move, it's important to realize that this is the most benign environment we've had in a long time as it relates to pension fund investing. For the past 20 years, interest rates have been either stable or coming down, and that has reduced the forward-looking return that investors were going to get. And so to some degree, that was driving the push into alternatives and other higher-yielding assets. Now, this has changed very quickly over the past 12 to 18 months. And if you were to do a simple math, you'll see that on average, the yield on your portfolio is at or above your assumed rate of return. Oh. And yields are very good predictors of future fixed income returns. On high quality bonds, you know, the R square or the coefficient correlation, meaning, you know, it's about 85%. So it's a good predictor of future returns. And if you look at credit areas after you adjust for defaults, it's also a very good predictor. So I think we're pretty comfortable stating that your fixed income assets, if held to maturity, should, you know, produce fairly compelling returns. So at this point in time, one can argue there's not as much need to move into super risky asset classes because bonds are yielding this. The issue is, where are rates going? The Fed could easily cut those back to more recent historical levels, you know, 2-3%. And if so, then, you know, we'll be again in a situation when investors may have to think twice about what they do. But at this instant, it's a very advantageous time, much better than probably any other time over the past 20 years.
Thanks, Lou. And you mentioned the aggregate yield to maturity. That's actually 7.5% across these asset classes here. And if you look at what that was at the end of 2021, it was 2.7. So that's come up a good bit and well above your expected rate. So the outlook for these assets is great going forward. I'll go ahead and move.
Hold on a second.
Sure. Yeah, quick question. We get to experience credit cycles like this every once in a while, and the current one is no exception. Any thoughts from Makeda as far as when and what the duration of this cycle will be and when we need to start thinking about the turn in terms of lower rates? The banking environment is falling apart. You know, we're going to see more regulation, and that, you know, that's going to change as to how involved they are. I guess any sense on pacing and perspective on when we need to give more attention to making adjustments in the equities versus the fixed income?
Yeah, so that's a good question. My understanding is that with the consultant search being behind us, beginning late this year, early next, the key focus area would be revisiting the asset allocation, and so those topics will be addressed. Is that correct, Brian? Is that what you have in mind?
Yeah, in terms of our asset allocation, we plan to kind of initiate it with the safety reserve discussion. What are we doing there? Relook at our long-term targets in early 24. I think one of the challenges with, you know, being a pension, we're setting an asset allocation for the long term and adjusting it every 3 years. So, and we don't have a lot of tactical, we're not making tactical moves in the portfolio. So it's
for adjusting fixed income, is that a three-year window? Is that a, you know, figuring out, making sure the ship's already sailed by the time you make an adjustment to the long term?
I just wanted to get a preview. That's all right.
Okay.
My personal view, I mean, first of all, we need to be mindful that, you know, you have a portion of your assets that we cannot move. So we only have, you know, roughly 70% that we can. But to me, right now, just peering back some of the gains in, you know, some of the bond categories that you see here on your equities and topping off your short duration bonds earning 5.5, whether it's cash or not, is a fantastic trade. Nobody went broke, you know, selling positions that went out.
Yeah.
As apropos to nothing, I'm just kind of curious from my own education. On the high yield, what is the default rate currently?
It's still fairly low. It has been taken up. I think it was about 2.5. Do you recall the number there?
I don't have it.
Sorry, that means some. I was just kind of curious as far as looking at that.
You mean it's been trending up, but still at very moderate levels, and there's obviously a recovery piece within it.
Right. Only because capital's more expensive, so I'm just assuming that's going to get higher.
Yes. Pardon me. There is the expectation that, you know, if the economy continues to struggle or begins to struggle more than it has, then those will go up. Certainly in some areas, there is more stress than others. I think your portfolio is still pretty robust where we stand. I don't have the exact number. We can look it up to see whether it's really pretty high yield or say high yield asset class.
It looks like it was kind of like 1.2 over the summer and it picked up to 2.6 in the last month. So moving a little bit, but not blowing out or anything.
It's still very low.
Yeah.
So with overnight rates are up, so risk-free rates are up, which means returns on all asset classes should be up. And so how do you think about the current short-term dynamic with fixed income and kind of where we're going longer term? And then also, like, for just a really high-performing, well-funded pension, what's the general asset allocation mix you see between fixed income, public equity, and alternatives? Like, what does that look like?
Great question. So the increase in interest rates happened very quickly. Very few investors have reacted to dramatically alter their asset allocation. Most successful investors, the ones that you define as having been well-funded and produced good returns, have had a fairly high allocation to alternative assets, which, if you look at over the last decade, they've done quite well. They pair back fixed income to maybe into the single digits. So in other words, they took on risk and they were rewarded for it. And like other environments, when we had the correction 18 months ago, fixed income also suffered that double digit losses unless you were in short duration keeps or essentially cash. A number of investors have moved to top up the cash and essentially short duration, high quality bonds, some even immunizing the short end of the liability stream, but it's been a minority. I haven't seen many investors make bets one way or the other about where rates are going. One could argue, okay, we're towards the end of the rate increase cycle, so maybe we need to add to long duration bonds. I haven't seen many of those, at least not in the public fund space. In the corporate world, it's a different mechanism for covering your liability stream. So some have moved that way. So long story short, not a lot of changes, but it'd be interesting to see what happens over the next year or so. I think a lot of this will be predicated on where interest rates go, and there's still some uncertainty, although most expect them to stabilize and then be cut at some point in time. If that happens, then I don't think there'll be any meaningful changes. If the rates were to stay at 6% or above for a sustained period of time, some investors may decide, okay, I don't need to take as much risk. The issue in the past was when we had this level of rates, maybe 2 decades ago or beyond, assumed rate of returns were high, so they've been coming down. So now that delta, the differential versus where rates are now and what is needed has become more compressed. The issue is, will that risk be maintained, or is that going to widen again as it was in the past? Does that answer, Tony?
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we had a discussion internally yesterday on kind of safe reserve, where we're going. I think one thing we need to look at as we get closer to doing asset allocation is where we're at compared to peers of our size, and then we kind of need to layer on top of that our liquidity constraints going forward. But I would say where we're at now is not by target, not by actual allocation, not too different from peers of our size with, we got 13% investment grade, you know, 60% equity, and then 15 long-term target to private markets.
I'll go ahead and wrap up on John.
I think he might. John, are you working on the Zoom? I figured you were, I could tell.
Okay.
So we've lost the presentation just for a minute. I don't know if you can talk to.
Yeah, I can make some comments. I'll just pull it up on my end so I can see. I'll go ahead and just touch briefly on past performance. As we had just talked about for a while, the outlook looks really strong going forward with rates being up so high, but historically, performance has also done really strong on a relative basis compared to the broad index. So over every trailing period, the total fixed income and cash composite has outperformed the Bloomberg Multiverse, and especially recently very, very strongly, the broad bond market has returned negatively over the 1 and 3 year trailing periods, largely as a result of rising interest rates globally. But this portfolio has held up well and has produced strong positive returns over this period. There's two reasons for that. One is the allocation, the diversification within credit allocations to bank loans and high yield bonds, which have both performed very strongly over the 1 and 3 year periods relative to your more core bonds, which are negative. Also, and then Lee's going to touch on this when he does the performance report in a minute, almost all of the managers that are held within this portfolio have outperformed their individual indices over most periods. And so manager selection looks really strong within within the portfolio as well. So we're gaining relative performance through allocation to those other asset classes as well as manager selection.
Colin, since Bill's not on board anymore, I'll ask a question that he brought up a few times. Do you think the multiverse is a fair benchmark for how we're allocated in fixed income?
I'll take that one. The good thing about it is a very broad one, and so it covers the whole universe. Some investors may choose to invest more abroad. The main counter-argument would be about 40% of it is accounted for in non-U.S. holdings, in other words, in other government issues from Europe, Japan, and whatnot. To the extent that there is a long-term plan to invest primarily in the U.S., then one could argue, well, maybe we should look at a U.S. benchmark. I think the reason why we have it is in the global equity space, we have the broadest global benchmark. And at a point in time, we weren't discussing what made sense. Okay, let's just use the parallel to that on the fixed income space. Nikita is open to it. We have clients that use like an aggregate, whether it's U.S. or global, as opposed to a multiverse. You can always compare to both if the group wanted to. But I think if you were to look at each individual fund versus their own benchmark, which is very specific, they're also doing quite well. So overall, we don't have any concerns with performance, but we could certainly add a secondary benchmark or replace it. Perhaps when we're doing the full asset allocation next year, we can revisit benchmarks again.
Yeah, I mean, I just think like on the longer term returns, that performance, part of that is the benchmark being more global, and part of it is our managers outperforming their own benchmark.
Well, the issue is when you think about global, right? So currency takes a much more important role in fixed income than in equities. The reason being is fixed income returns tend to be more muted. And so when you have 40% in foreign holdings and the dollar, you know, has been quite strong, then your foreign denominated assets, when you bring them back into dollars, will have losses. So the currency translation explains some of that outperformance. And then the rest, as you mentioned, is the allocation. So, you know, shorter duration, that has helped on the high quality bonds, outperformance by managers, having, you know, a 4% target to bank loans, which perform really well. So there's a combination of factors, but certainly the more diverse with the 40% weight to non-U.S. assets has also been, you know, something that over the last year in particular looks very favorable. Yeah. Any questions on fixed income, please? So let's move on to the performance. Thanks. Can you get us to the beginning of the performance, John, or should I move up? It's going to be faster. Thank you. So this is a snapshot on page 52 of the pension fund. That's just looking back 1 year. So you can see a very strong performance. It looks, shows 17% gain. Again, as it was mentioned earlier, some of these, in fact, I would argue about 6% or so is due to the markup in the half energy fund, which happened at the end of last year. So that has helped, but even if you were to take that out, the performance has been quite strong versus policy and also pretty decent versus peers. If you look at the median fund, only gain about 7.7%, so there was more to it than just a markup in one asset. What hurt during the last year was being underweight global equities versus our own policy benchmark. But if we compare to many other peers, we have a pretty large weight to listed equities, and so that has been a benefit in relative terms versus peers. Our managers, on average, you know, have to be better than their benchmarks, but when you put them all together, compared to a 60-40 blend, 60% equities, 40% bonds, or compared to other peers, you know, still very strong performance across all of your public managers. All the asset classes are in compliance with targets, although some may be ahead or behind their targets, but certainly within ranges. So overall, a pretty good 1 year look back, but also if you were to look at three months or 6 months, it looks still quite strong. Look at this chart already, so I'm going to skip it. This is important. Here we show the exposure to essentially very liquid positions, daily or weekly, monthly. I would still put it in the very liquid category, and then the rest that is illiquid, which is quarterly or no liquidity at all. And so that is 28% exposure today versus a target of 15. It's been coming down from being the majority of the pie chart to now being about a quarter. As Nick mentioned, there's a number of positions that account for it. So half being one with a very large weight, there's a number of others that it. So there's a few positions that if and when they get resolved, you know, this number will come down to 15% or even below it, depending on whether it's at once or in multiple tranches. The 15% is not a... sort of like a long-term target to have when we were at a much larger allocation to liquid. So I would imagine this number will be discussed when we do asset allocation. It may remain or it may change, but now we're getting close to it, to being at a time when we could potentially make new commitments and investments in the illiquid categories. This quarterly manager scorecard is something that you all had requested a couple of years ago. So what we do is we look at each of your public market strategies and look at 1, 3, and 5 years versus the respective benchmarks and just provide a quick snapshot. Are they ahead or behind? There's some caveats here. If you were to look, for example, at Boston Partners and Manulife, one is ahead, one is behind, for example, over 5 years, it helps to know, okay, what kind of a strategy is it, what is the selected benchmark. Generally speaking, your global equity managers have benchmark against a core mandate. If you were to use the respective value indices, I think each of these is ahead on every single period. But against the core, it's been hard to be a value manager over the past couple of years, with the exception of maybe about a 12 or 18 month cycle. And so it's no surprise that, you know, three are negatives, especially over the last year where growth has been really, really strong. On the positive side, both of your emerging market strategies have done well. On the equity side, RBC, very strong outperformance over recent quarters, and Midlife is much newer, so we don't have a lot of data, but they also started to be strong. And this was also something that you requested, so we tracked these for you. Let me go back to this page. Boston Partners, you see that they're lagging over 5 years and also over the 1 year. So one of the issues for them has been that they have for a while been underweight to the U.S. versus peers and versus benchmarks. And the U.S. has performed the best among various geographies. And as a result, that has explained some of their lag as well. They continue to view greater value opportunities in markets outside of the U.S. And, you know, that's what we pay them for. We pay them for them to express their view in their portfolio, so it's okay to have dissenting views. If and that won't change, then that portfolio should perform. It's been consistently underexposed to the U.S. But the beauty of this chart is you can see across and aggregate and adapt and see, okay, where are the overweights and underweights of different geographic exposures. So if you look at the total, the equity exposure to the U.S. across the whole equity book is 51%. The benchmark is 61%. So we have about a 10% deficit. 8% of that 10 goes into developed markets, so 37 versus 29, and then emerging is 12 versus 10. So it has fluctuated over time. I would say consistently we've been somewhat underexposed to the U.S., so that has been a headwind over recent times. I know in the past there has been an issue of debate within this group, but also within the investment advisory committee. It's hard to know which section or geography will perform better. I know that if we had stopped the clock on December 31, 1999 or 2000, after a decade or so of very strong run in the U.S., and we had put all the money in the U.S., then it was a great decade for investment outside of the U.S., developed markets, particularly emerging markets. If you do that again, and you focus at the end of 2010 in investment overseas, then you would have not performed well because the last decade has been very strong for the U.S. So it's hard to know. These things go in cycles. It's good to have exposure to all of those. And ultimately, we have delegated, if you will, most of these to managers because we don't control. If you wanted to control that, then we'll have to get rid of the global exposure and have very specific allocations to the U.S., non-U.S., et cetera. We don't have that. But we try to control somewhat through the addition of small cap packets, and so we can make changes there because we have U.S. and non-U.S. components. Any questions so far? Okay. Here's the performance versus our own policy, and then we'll have performance, if I skip, versus peers in the next couple of pages. Here's the attribution. So we try to break down for you what has worked and what has not. This is over the past 3 months. Keep in mind the range is at the bottom. So the scale, when we look at the next page and we look at the year, it's a different scale. So keep things in perspective. But if you look at the private equity line, the fourth from the top, and you see another performance, well, during these 3 months, there was a write-down. And so what you see there is that explains the underperformance versus our own policy. And if you were to look at the last year, you'll see now it's a much greater scale. So instead of talking about a percent or two, we're talking about 6 to 8% on the right. This is the opposite, and so it was the big write-up on the half-energy fund. So you'll see that the rest is kind of more muted when you have these big jumps in that fund. And so that has been driving, you know, exit performance or underperformance some of the quarters. The next set of pages break out performance over multiple rolling periods, first by asset class, and then we look at each of the managers. We also provide some perspective as to, you know, where our 60-40 portfolio is, where peers are, so we have some rankings as well. But no surprises, again, as Colin mentioned, generally speaking, your public managers are performing well. Those are the areas where we can make changes. From the private or the liquid, there's really no opportunity there. So about once a year, there's been a change in your portfolio. Like the most recent one was the hiring of MetLife in your emerging market debt. Prior to that, it was Longfellow on your core bond portfolio. And now we're in the process, and as you heard from Brian, we'll be looking at a replacement for Invesco in the coming weeks. One comment for those that are newer to the board, when you see the rank, one means you're at the top, 99 means you're at the bottom. So the issues in your private markets portfolio in the long term have been a detriment to the fund's performance. So that's why you see long term figures not ranking 99. Essentially, it's been an anchor, and so with limited assets performing and some of those essentially non-performing, some of those essentially held at cost, has been a headwind when the market was going up. More recent performance has been stronger. Some of that, again, the write-up of one asset, but the rest has been good performance by the rest of your portfolio. You can also look at every strategy and see how they fare. So, for example, if you look at both the partners and Manulife, you know, you can see how they rank versus the value benchmark, how they compare to other value managers. So picking on both the partners, if we look at, I don't know, the year-to-date figure, they make 6%. It looks very weak against the global benchmark that made 15. But compared to the value benchmark that made only 4%, they don't look that bad. So these past few quarters has been a period where growth, the growth sector has performed very strongly, and it was driven in particular by a number of holdings, mostly related to artificial intelligence. And so if you have been invested in those stocks, you did really well, otherwise you lack. Let's skip a few pages here. So here we look at targets versus actual exposure. On the left, by broad asset classes, on the right, being more nimble. So if you were to add up public equity on the left, on the top with private equity, as our total equity exposure, pretty much combined, close to target. We're about 4% underweight to fixed income, and most of that is accounted for in our real assets, mostly in real estate, which is overweight. If you look at on the right, you see a lot of them are pretty close. Again, private equity and real estate are the ones that are most overweight and consequently were underweight at global equity primarily. This is good for those that are newer to the fund. You look at the light blue, and that is public equity. It comprised about 25% of the total fund about 5 years ago, and a much smaller percent. I think it was about as low as 10%. Yeah. My memory doesn't fail me, about 2016 or so. So it has come up meaningfully from about 10% to 50%, 51.6, I think was the latest number.
Can I just point one thing? Councilman Mendelson, when we talk about we think that we've achieved a level of stability that wasn't here before, and you would ask us just put forth basic evidence that would show that, I would put this chart among the top, that along with the returns. Makita uses kind of a day-glow green to show their positives, and you would see that. Ryan used kind of a burnt orange color on his chart. And I think actually he had to change printer toner recently after not having to
replace it for 15 or 20 years on positive returns. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that, that we would want you to sort of be in tune with, and once again, appreciate you being here, of the things that we would put forth to say, if we were to receive additional funding, this is what we would show to say we think we could be good stewards of it.
I think your slide with 17% was very compelling.
Yeah. But this chart here is one where there's a suitability issue. When I look back at the portfolio when I first started, whether they made money or lost money, and most lost money, I think Leo would agree, there was just a whole cascade of unsuitable investments for a pension fund. That when you see this sort of evolution over time, that these are suitable investments along with a few legacy investments that really aren't, there's just that whole issue as it relates to how public money should, you know, in a pension should be invested. So, and unfortunately, a lot of those unsuitable investments, which could have made money, you know, a lot of them didn't. But
yeah.
Leo, you'd largely agree with
yeah,
that.
I would. I wouldn't say necessarily unsuitable. I mean, the allocation to liquids was somewhat larger than peers, but not unreasonable. So, I would say it was an issue of execution and risk management, meaning perhaps too high a concentration in just a number of general partners, and too large a concentration in a number of funds, and if those go south, then have a lot of capital tied up in a handful of underperformance. So there's not the diversification over time, over funds, over partners that perhaps would have been
yeah.
more prudent.
But a lot of them were single asset investments
yeah.
as well.
Yeah,
yeah.
No so more limited. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think
yeah,
you
but
should,
in addition,
I think you after some of those things that kind of come and gone.
Yeah. And a really high energy focus too, right, within that bucket.
It was a fairly high allocation to energy. So again, the concentration into either a fund, a single asset, a general partner, so an issue of less than ideal diversification.
Yeah, I would suggest that it wouldn't have been almost any of those investments that would have been on your recommended list.
No,
yeah.
I thought we'd pass on many of
so
those,
so,
or
be,
all of those.
That
yeah.
would be my evidence.
All of
them.
So the other report that we have for you is a report on the private market. So maybe we'll touch a little bit on this next. Keep in mind, for those that are new, again, at about 7 or so years ago, this fund held a much larger allocation to liquids. So to meet an increasing demand on cash flow needs, many of these assets were packaged and sold, and capital came back. And so what remains are some positions that were not sold for a variety of reasons. Some were, didn't have a market, or the discount was too high. And so staff categorized the remaining private market assets into either, you know, ongoing assets or legacy. Most were legacy assets. Now, a lot of this money over the past, you know, 7 years has come back, but we still have some positions with meaningful exposures. And so the performance that you see in some cases represents, you know, just that in some of these reports of what we still have in the books, not the whole program. So we'll touch on that. This is, again, something relatively new. So we're showing the change during the quarter and what happened versus the last time we reported. Also, it's good to keep in mind that there is always a lag in reporting private market assets, so the statements come to us with a delay. And so what we're showing here is the performance as of March 31st. So right now, the June 30th have begun to come. We don't have those, and there's always a consistent one-quarter lag. So as long as it's consistently applied, that is pretty much industry standard or best practice today. So here we have across the aggregation of equity, real estate, infrastructure, energy, timber. We have commitments of 1.46 million. We have the call amount or what was invested, what has come back to us, and what is our, you know, remaining exposure or net asset value, which you see there on the right. It was 595 million. as of the end of last year. During the quarter, it came down to 559, so we have seen that happening over most quarters. The primary explanation has been distribution, so in this case, $33 million, but we also have some very minor adjustment down in value of about $3 million. And so the change in performance is about 50 basis points adjustment. Below you see the main distributions, one on the real estate from AEW, and then the other one on the infrastructure fund with JP Morgan. Next, we break it into each of the main categories. So you see private equity, just no distributions, minor adjustments to the NAV. On real estate, the primary distribution on AEW and Hamel Square accounted for the majority of it, and no change to the valuation. Infrastructure, no change, and a distribution on JP Morgan. And then on agriculture, a $2 million downward adjustment to your book. That is on Manulife or Hancock, was known. And then timber, this is a smaller position. It's what we would call legacy, so it's eventually on its way out. It's a number of holdings and a minor adjustment of $1 million. So overall, not a lot of adjustment in terms of valuation, but two meaningful distributions during the quarter. As Ryan alluded, in the past few months, that has trickled down, and it's been much more muted at about $2 million, I think you said,
$2.5 million.
The rest is more of a standard report, so I'll just go a bit more quickly. This provides a snapshot. So private equity, real estate, the two largest. I would say the agriculture is the only one that is more or less an ongoing, separately measured account, at close to a 5% target of the total fund. And that is the one that has, quite a strong performance. The manager came back a few months ago, presented and shared, the plans to continue to manage that those assets, including potentially some transactions and some reallocation within its portfolio. Here we see performance. So there's two colors. The blue is the distribution ratio to paid in capital, so how much money has come back versus what was put in. And so you'll see in agriculture it's been quite strong. About 2.4 times money invested has been returned to you. And if you look at the green, that is the total value. So that includes money distributed plus what's on your books. So compounding at about 3.5 times your money. The rest of the portfolio is a lot flat. So if you see one, that means, hey, the money that I put in is what I have it on the books. The issue here is the opportunity cost. So if you have that money for 20 years and the markets move up, that's all that you've given up. And you'll see on infrastructure, private equity, all of those, distributions have not yet been to the point of the money invested. Timber has been the smallest allocation, but also the one with the most challenged performance.
I don't think we need to go into this level detail.
Okay, perfect. So I think
I'd just like to make two more points. If you go to the actual end where you have the total real assets program, the last disclosure. So
okay.
Page 105, I think it is. Okay. So if you'll just zoom that up a little bit, if you look, the things that I would look at, is that just on the real assets program, you have paid in capital of $968 million. You can see the year, the vintage year. So the capital draws were over years from the vintage year on. And then if you look at the TVPI ratio of 1.04, a basic sort of rule of seven, if you get 7% return every year, you double your money every 10 years. And yet, here we did, we only grew $1 to $1.04. I think there's a Bible story about that, too. But to me, I look at this, and this is time theft. Absolute. That $968 million should have easily doubled if there was just baseline performance. What could we do with an extra $968 million? Likewise, if you scroll below, you see in private equity, it's 768. There, you turn a dollar into a dollar 13 over this same, decade plus long period. Once again, if we had just gotten a 7% return, which was easily gotten in the public markets at that time, or in the private markets with a more competent program, once again, you would have, billion plus more of money available to pay our obligation. So I think it's always important to highlight the cost of bad private decisions, because once you do it, you can't really change it. And this is the situation, that we've inherited that I think we've stabilized, but we still have a long more way to go. So
thank you. That concludes our remarks. If you have any questions, please.
Okay.
All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to jump around, and we're going to do Kelly's executive report, then go into closed session.
Right. Okay, thank you, guys. For the executive director's report, it's the same stuff that you see every month. The association newsletters included for you. We had four open records requests of the last meeting. Three were from the same member, and then one was an outside person. As far as employee updates go, you met Christina. We're very happy that she's back. I was sad when she left, so very happy she's back. We had a new benefits counselor start, Aubrey Rosales. She is phenomenal, trains really fast. So we're full staffed in our benefits area, which is great. And Brenda hit her five-year mark with the pension system last month. So that's it. Employee updates. All I have.
So we're going to go into closed session.